Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Unbelievers. I'm Cams, your host, an unbeliever, and I'm joined by...
Yeah, by Bodge, the unbeliever.
So two unbelievers together talking about another unbeliever, Thomas Covenant.
Right, and I wonder how many unbelievers there are in the audience who are like me on the journey for the first time and who are sticking with it.
Yeah, that would be good to know.
We're at this kind of juncture where, I mean, Thomas Covenant is, he's convinced he's in a dream. But is he? And let's find out.
And we've also just crossed the Rubicon. This is the point where we might have lost a few listeners, having just finished Chapter 7, where the violation scene takes place. And I know from having seen online over the years on Kevin's Watch Forum and places like that, that that's the scene that makes a lot of people quit. So if you're still with us, nice one, glad to have you. We're going to get some of the consequences now.
And it's an interesting kind of journey to go along with a hero that is displaying behaviour that, is pretty despicable. So it's interesting to see how this develops. I mean, yeah, let's go with it.
An anti-hero, I guess you would call him.
Well, at the moment.
So we're in Chapter 8, the title of which is The Dawn of the Message. So we're covering just one chapter today. We start where we finished, where Covenant has just done the deed. He's violated young Lena. She's run off. And then he falls asleep, I guess.
Yeah, so, I mean, his lust takes over. He violates her. And then he vomits, right? He gets rid of something, and then there's this sense of the river taking it away, right? And then he wakes up the next morning, and he actually feels really good. He's just aware that he's had an orgasm and how it's like almost impossible.
Yeah, heart-rending. So precious that he would have been willing to coin his soul to make such things part of his real life. For a long moment of joy, he re-experienced that sensation. Then he remembered that to get it, he had hurt Lena.
Right. So, then what does he do? Like, so he plans to flee, right? Gradually Covenant's panic receded. After a last look around, he began to prepare for what lay ahead of him. And then he decides just to suppress the memory and keep moving, survive, and all that stuff. He just doesn't want to go back to what he did.
So his first kind of action is to put himself through a thorough VSE, virtual surveillance of extremities, which is his ritual to check whether he's been hurt or is in any danger.
Yeah, and he finds that actually he's not going to be running away because just there in the banks is a tiara. She's standing there looking at him.
So before that, he jumps in the water, doesn't he? He jumps into the river and feels the seductive pull of the water, urging him to float off under the blue skies. But he doesn't. He washes himself, and that's when he sees Atiaran when he comes back out from having ducked his head under the water.
And then, I mean, what must be going through his head? Like, does she know? And what's happening? And he tries to figure out. She doesn't say much. She says, she basically tells him to come along and get dry.
Yeah.
And so he assumes that she doesn't know.
Which is a surprise to him.
She even then tells him that Lena told Trell that he was here. So basically he's surprised that there's no accusation, no... and so he kind of tests it a bit further, and he asks her if she actually saw Lena.
That's right, yeah.
And Atiyaran says that she didn't. She went to spend a night with a friend and just shouted out from outside as she passed the house.
So she's come to take him to Revelstone.
Right, but I mean, yeah, and so Covenant basically figures out from that that she hasn't been told, and that what Lena is doing is to sacrifice herself,
yeah,
in a sense, and because she thinks that he's Beric Halfhand, and rather than, as it were, draw attention to revenge or something, she wants him to get on with his mission, I guess.
Yeah.
And so she's willing to do that.
So because of his status, she's sacrificing herself for the good of the land.
Yep. And so then Atiyaran says about needing to guide him to Lord's Keep.
Yeah. So we're told then about the fact that the Cave Wight has found the Staff of Law, so that's been reintroduced as the theme of the opening of the novel. So we're talking about Drool Rockworm, and he says, I gather he doesn't really know how to use it. Somehow the lords have got to get it away from him. So that's the mission. And then Atiyaran explains that Revelstone is 300 leagues, which I had to look up. So it's basically 900 miles.
Right.
1,500 kilometres.
Yeah, I had to look it up too. Yeah.
So how does Covenant know how far a league is without having to have it explained to us? Or does he?
Well, I guess, I mean, it was fairly common parlance, no? I mean, when I looked it up, it said that leagues kind of differed in terms of the distance.
Yeah, he's from Haven Farm in America. So his first question should have been, how far's that in miles then?
I see.
Or maybe he just accepts it's a long way and just goes along with it.
Yeah, and I guess his mind isn't particularly clear at the moment.
No.
He'll come up against distance later on.
Yeah. So we get another mention here of the Ranahan, which are the horses of the land, and they cannot go to them for help, she says. The Raman have little countenance for the affairs of the land, and no Ranahan has been ridden save by Lord or Bloodguard since the age began. So we must walk, Thomas Covenant.
So the Ranahan are different from regular horses, I take it, because there is, I remember reference to horses. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were mentioned earlier somewhere, and so were the Raman, who are the ones who look after the Ranahan. And I can't remember what it said previously, but they were definitely brought up before.
Right, so what's happening? So she's basically presenting herself as the guide, and she asks him if he trusts her to guide him. Because she says, I failed in the Lorestadt.
Lorestadt. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You've got some German knowledge. Mm. Is that rat anything like the German rat?
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe Dutch, you know, or Scandinavian, but the same kind of thing, rat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of advisory place, or, you know, a municipal building, or official type kind of, you know, policy making building type thing.
Right.
Or
I think this is more like an academy of some sort.
Right.
Where one studies the lore. Which we get to in a bit, in the big info dump about the lore of the land. So she's quite down on herself. She doesn't see herself as having enough status to be his guide because she failed. And she also has a feeling that he knows more than he's letting on. And she accuses him of that when he starts talking about the message that he was given again. And she says, I think you are too eager to know my ignorance. But then she goes on to talk to him about the history of the land, basically. What she learned at the Lord's Rat, who the lords are. And she mentions the Ravers for the first time. I don't believe they've been mentioned before. The spies.
Are these the giants?
No. The giants are the ones who built Revelstone for Lorik, High Lord Lorik.
Yeah, the giants are the good guys, huh? I mean, doesn't it say that they weren't affected by the desolation? Oh, we come to that later on.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't Lorik, was it Damalon? It was Lord Damalon, because he's known as Lord Damalon, giant friend. So he was Lord of Revelstone the giants built Revelstone out of the rock for Damalon. That gets mentioned later. But here we've got the Ravers, the spies of the Grey Slayer. They cannot die while he yet lives. They have no bodies of their own, and their spirits wander until they find living beings which they can master. Thus they appear as animals or humans, as chance allows, corrupting the life of the land. So
She also mentions that they've got to pass Mount Thunder, which is a pretty dangerous place.
Yeah, that's where the Covenant was summoned to when he first appeared in Kiriel Threndor, which is Mount Thunder. That's where the cave was when Drill summoned him with the Staff of Law. And we also see Kevin's watch. We get another glance of Kevin's watch, but this time from below.
4,000 feet, indeed.
It's mentioned, yeah, so I've underlined that just to make note of the height of it.
Right. So they've set off. Thomas Covenant is convinced he's still in a dream. He's shamed and relieved that she hasn't discovered his secret and his night's work in his face, as it says. But he's feeling, so there is that guilt. But for the time being, he seems to escape any particular consequences.
Yeah.
Also, as they set off, he realizes that this is when he realizes that it's a massive distance and that she doesn't know that he's a leper.
Yeah. So even, I don't remember if he ever mentioned it to her, but even if he had, she wouldn't have known what it meant.
Yeah.
So we're reminded again of the desecration just as we go past Kevin's watch. He's reminded of his summoning. And she explains about Kevin Landwaster once again, High Lord and wielder of the staff, direct descendant of Beric Halfhand in the last battle against the Grey Slayer. Desecration, the end of all things in the land for many generations. So this is the most important part in the land's history, really, when it all changed. And that's kind of the starting point from the land's point of view that's led to where we are now.
Hmm. Right, so she's also beginning to get some misgivings about being followed. Well, she says, yeah, I feel something wrong upon our path this day. And he's also got misgivings kind of thing, but they have pangs of guilt.
Yeah.
But she does say that she feels they're being followed, perhaps.
Mm.
But anyway, yeah, and then she's giving him the lore.
Yeah, so we get an info dump here, which is another dense couple of pages with the land's history.
So yeah.
We get told about Beric's son, Damalon Giant Friend, and his son, Lorik Vile Silencer. So these are all lords. And it did mention somewhere that, yeah, Kevin was lord for 1,000 years when he stood at head of the council. So that's a surprise piece of information, that the lifespan of these inhabitants of the land is not like it is for us.
And also there's a sense, I mean, for anybody who hasn't read this before, like, that's okay, so, like, Beric Halfhand is like the father of this entire kind of ancestry.
Yeah, it's like the noble line almost.
Right.
And he was the one who defeated the Grey Slayer, or the darkness, or the cloud, or whatever it was, however they described it, after the king and queen of the land had divided and the king had been corrupted by the cloud or the darkness. And Beric was the queen's champion, and he defeated the darkness.
Right, so this is, I see, so this is chronologically comes after that, right?
Yeah, so.
So interesting. So then Kevin's rule was the, or Kevin's whatever, you know, stewardship was the time when the lore was gathered into the seven wards, is it?
Yeah. So he's, I guess, the fourth in line. So we've got Beric, we've got Damalon, we've got Lorik, and then we've got Kevin. So that could be 4,000 years or more if Kevin was lord for 1,000 years.
Right. So basically there was this span of time where there was, as it were, positive development in the land, and then the lore, yeah, the lore was collected.
It says that he gathers up the lore when he sees the first hints that the ancient shadow was alive.
Right.
That's when he gathered all his lore into seven wards. So I guess for 4,000 years or however long it was, after Beric defeated the shadow by calling the fire lions from Mount Thunder, when he swore an oath to the land, then the shadow must have been recovering or hiding, or, I don't know, a bit like Voldemort. That's what it makes me think of for some reason.
Right, or never completely defeated, or, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. I mean, or maybe it's not possible to do that. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it, right, so then during this, as it were, golden age, so to speak, then as the hint of the end of the golden age, period was coming, then Kevin kind of gets all the knowledge together in the form of the lore.
Yeah.
Right? Which gets divided into seven parts, seven wards.
Yes.
And then hidden.
And hidden, yeah. So that the knowledge would not pass from the land, even if he and the old lords fell.
Hmm. Right, so then whatever he was kind of sensing appears in the form of a Trojan horse, huh? The Grey Slayer rose up in the guise of a friend.
Yes. And he gets a seat in the council.
Yeah. Right, but that's that. The poison's in, and boom.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, end of peace, yeah.
So then he gets betrayed, and that will be when they set off the ritual of desecration. So it's Kevin who does that with the Staff of Law, and it's at that point that the Staff of Law is lost.
And I see.
The Grey Slayer then gets to have dominion over the destroyed land, I suppose.
Right, but it also said, then this is where we learn that the giants, rock brothers of the people of the land, had survived the ritual of desecration.
Yeah, exactly. And it was they who had stewardship over the first ward.
Yeah, right. And they swore to master the lore that they might heal the land and to master themselves, that they would not fall into the anger and despair which made Kevin his own worst foe.
Yeah.
Right, so they're kind of guardians of sorts, and in the period after the desecration, then they're part of the revival.
Yeah, well, they return with the first ward, and they, under the lordship of, no, back in, before the desecration, when they were building Revelstone for Damalon, giant friend, and Revelstone is the seat of the Council of Lords. The ageless castle city, which they had riven out of the rock of the mountain for High Lord Damalon as surety of the bond between them. Oh, actually, yeah, so this is when they return the first ward of Kevin's Lower, for he had trusted it to the giants before the last battle, and the people accepted that ward and consecrated themselves, swearing earth friendship and loyalty to the power and beauty of the land. So we don't know how much time has passed since the desecration when Beric forms this noble line or whatever it is, this Council of Lords.
Right. You mean before the first desecration?
No, there's only one desecration.
Oh, so the Kevin desecration is the only one?
Yeah.
So before Beric was the big battle?
It was the big battle, yeah.
Big, right, I see. And then the giants survived the desecration, which was the Kevin desecration.
Yes.
Right, right. So we don't know how long after this desecration we're in the current time.
That's right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, right. We do get a sense of the scope of the lore, which I thought was really well described, no?
Yeah. So that from the beginning of the second era up until now, the lords have been working with only the first ward, and they haven't mastered that.
Yeah.
And there are seven.
And it says, yeah, the lord is a deep matter not mastered yet, despite all the years and effort that have been given to it.
Mm.
The chiefest problem is translation. I really like that. For the language of the old, yeah, for the old lords was not like ours, and the words which are simple at one place are difficult at another.
Yeah.
The words. And after translation, the law must then be interpreted, and the skills to use it must be learned.
Yeah. So there's a lot been lost.
And all the knowledge in the lore's rot is just 1/7 of the whole.
Yeah, and it's not all of that 1/7 either.
Right.
Because they haven't mastered it.
Right, right.
So all they really have, it says the easiest of translation was the war lore. Arts of battle and defence. So there's a war word, which I guess is the army of Lord's Keep. But there have been no wars in our time, which is interesting, because we're talking maybe 4,000 years No, since Kevin till now. We don't know how long that is.
We don't know how long that is, exactly.
But they haven't had any wars, so what's Lord Fowl been up to in all of that time? We don't know. It's been a time of peace.
Yeah. And there's a bit where Auntie Aran, she's talking about, well, she's talking about the lore in terms of, you know, what she learned and her experience at the Loris Rat, and she then goes on to say why she gave up. And that was interesting. Because it's almost like she gave up because she couldn't bear to feel or experience the dark intensity.
Mm.
It says over here, that which I learned made my heart quail. When the Loris wardens led me to see just a little way into the despite of the Grey Slayer,
yeah,
that I could not bear. And so I broke my devotion and returned.
So that's a theme of this, is the ritual of desecration is described as having happened because of Kevin's despair. That he gave in to the despair. And Ati Aran's not willing to do that, is the feeling I'm getting here. That to learn of the despair is perhaps too much for one to take. It's risky. But they also have knowledge of the ritual of desecration, which Kevin would not have had at that time, because there had never been one.
Oh, I see.
So now the lower wardens are conscious of what it can lead to.
I mean, one thing that occurs to me as, you know, a newbie to all this is like, okay, so Kevin invoked the desecration. So, I mean, that's so he called it upon the land, and that must have been, as it were, a lesser evil than the alternative, I would imagine. Otherwise, why do it? Unless, of course, Kevin, like, why would you rule, you know, like a good guy for 1,000 years and then turn?
So rather than allow the Grey Slayer to take the land, he would rather destroy it.
Well, that seems to be a possibility then. I mean, because, you know, the Grey Slayer, so the Trojan horse came in the form of a friend, right? And then became a war lord, and then the poison was in the system.
Yeah.
He had sensed that already, because he had done the prep by kind of putting the lore together and then hiding it.
Yeah.
He then must have made the connection that this is what I had sensed coming into being, right? So yeah, to my mind anyway, the desecration then sounds like certainly a lesser of the two, and some sort of maybe protective move.
Yeah, particularly given the fact that he's secured the lore for future retrieval.
Right. And it's not clear whether he knew the giants would survive, but, I mean, he gave it to them, and maybe he had a sense of that, and maybe he even forewarned them so that they could, who knows?
Yeah. But it's also, his desperation at that time wouldn't have been dissimilar to Beric's despair when the Fire Lions came to his rescue. Because he was defeated as he stood on the hillside, and then he swore his oath to the earth in return for aid from the Fire Lions of Mount Thunder. So he took a different route, although I suppose he didn't have an alternative other than his own destruction.
But that's it. That's the big difference, right? It's his individual destruction, isn't it? Because, I mean, the battle's lost, he's fled, it's just him.
No, but the land would have been lost.
Right, yeah, no, he did know that when he took the oath, because the rock said to him that you will have a friend, and yeah, all right.
Earth friend, I think.
But he didn't, I mean, he did it, yeah, exactly, this is like, yeah, either you do this or you die. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, okay, do it then. Whereas with Kevin, then it's a far more considered thing.
Yeah, it was prepared for, wasn't it?
Right, so in the story, where are we then? So she's giving him this, all this lore that we've been discussing.
Yeah, yeah. And then she questions him about his message, and he says, "I'm not your bloody Beric." Because she seems to think that he knows more than he's letting on, so he reiterates his message to her and explains, because she's surprised how he knows who the current lord is, because she doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's like, "Yeah, you taking the piss, Thomas Covenant?" He's like, no, here's the message I was given again. And he says it word for word, and during the message it is told to us that High Lord Prothol, son of Dwellian.
Yeah.
So we've got that.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see the effect of just uttering those words on everything around. It's like, you know, the birds stop chirping, and it has just uttering the words.
Yeah, it does, and, see that, yeah. And the stream appeared motionless.
Right, exactly, yeah. It's like poison, or... Actually, no, it doesn't, not necessarily. But it has an effect. For an instant, complete silence surrounded him. The birds were as silent as if they had been stricken out of the sky, and the stream appeared motionless. Yeah.
And then Atiaran gaped and cries out, "Melin Curion Abatha," which I've underlined. No other explanation is given. "Do not speak it until you must." So it's kind of like not saying the name of Voldemort out loud. It's like an omen.
I guess, and that's, I don't know, like saying whatever.
Yeah.
Three Hail Marys to cancel it out.
Aye.
Right.
And then she says to him, "You are close to me, Thomas Covenant. I do not see you." And she means by the word "see" as if she meant something he did not understand.
And then when she repeats it, she says, "I do not know whether you are well or ill."
Aye. And that's when he gets his chance to tell her.
Yeah.
"I'm ill, of course. I'm a leper." And then she groaned as if he had just confessed to a crime. "Then woe to the land, for you have wild magic and can undo us all." And he's like, "What? It's just a ring. What are you on about? It's got no more wild magic than a rock," which is kind of the wrong analogy, isn't it? Because in the land, the earth is the source of all power, is her response.
And, yeah, there's a lot of jumping about. I mean, like, does she then know what a leper is?
It's not made clear, but he does use the word "ill," so I suppose you can put two and two together.
So basically she says she doesn't know whether he's ill or well.
Yes.
And maybe because if that ticks the ill box, then we're doomed. I see.
Yeah.
Right. And then there's the follower. Then there's this interesting kind of play out of events.
Yeah, we get a bit of an action scene here. A young man appears, unmistakably a stone downer. So at this point, we don't know who he is. And he yells at him and calls him a raver. And this used to be funny to us because we read this in the 90s, which for those that don't know was a period of raves in Scotland anyway, or in the UK, I suppose, throughout, was when all the acid house was kicking off and raves were a big thing. So this was written in the 70s before any of that was a thing. But it was quite culturally amusing to us all.
Right, so this guy appears, Atiaran runs off, and Thomas actually turns around and stands to face the attacker.
And he gets cut on his hands, and that's when Atiaran calls out, Treorc.
Right. So there's one thing, though, by saying Ravisher, it's clear that he knows what Thomas Covenant has done.
Yes, and there was a bit where I wrote down earlier on when Atiaran says the bitter vehemence of her reply surprised him. So when she said, she's talking about the Lord's Rat, and I've written on the side, she knows, says the bitter vehemence of her reply surprised him. Do you remind me that I am, of all people, the least worthy to talk of these matters? You, Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and white gold wielder, do you reproach me? So at that point, I thought, maybe she knows. Just the way that she's throwing it back at him. But then it's revealed that she didn't, so...
Yeah. So, yeah, so it's clear that she knows the attacker, Treorc. So she says, yeah.
So we know him too. He has been mentioned before, but only once and in passing.
Right, he's the guy who fancies Lena.
Yeah, we did chat about that on a previous episode. That she thought that she would be tied down if she went with him, because he had no ambition, whereas she did.
Right, yes.
So he's obviously in love with her, and now he wants to defend her honour and kill Covenant.
And so he slashes out and...
Yeah. And then Atiaran reminds him of his oath of peace. Interesting.
And she forbids him from taking revenge. And you might think that Thomas Covenant would be kind of, like, mortified, right? But he's totally oblivious.
Yeah, it's well written, this scene.
He's like, you know, like, he's just fascinated that he's got feeling in his fingers.
Yeah, I've written that on the side here. Still oblivious when it's all going down, and he's like, impossible, can't happen, nerves don't regenerate. After having just been revealed as a rapist in front of the victim's mother, he's not even aware of what's going on. So I suppose that gives a sense of just how powerful this must feel to him as a leper, to have no hope. Because it is, we do get a callback of something that the doctor said to him, that there's no hope.
Yeah, right. You can't afford to have hope.
Yeah. So despite what's going on, all he can think about is the fact that he's got some feeling, that the cut on his hand is painful.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's cleverly written. And then he says it can't happen. Of course it can't. That proves this is all a dream.
Yeah, right. So that just reinforces whatever he thinks about. Yeah, he thinks about that and what that can justify and things. Yeah, but Treorc explains to Atiaran, like, what happened, basically, and because he's in love with her, so he went out to try and find her, and then she basically didn't want to tell him, but did.
Yeah.
He doesn't like that Atiaran is not letting him kill Thomas, or, you know, and even has a go at her, saying, you know, you're a mother, what, you know.
Yeah, but she just reiterates the oath of peace one more time.
And then, she's, like, really sad and says, alas, for the young in the world, you know, why is the burden of hating ill so hard to bear? And then she says, Lena, my daughter, I see what you have done. I understand it is a brave deed worthy of praise and pride. Forgive me that I cannot be with you in this trial.
Yeah.
So, is she understanding the same thing that, I don't know, maybe we understood earlier on that Lena was kind of sacrificing herself for the good of the nation by not having told her immediately.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Is that what it is?
Hmm. Yeah, must be. I've underlined that section as well.
Hmm.
And then Treorc says, does he go unpunished? And she goes on to talk about the peril in the land. Let the lords punish him.
Hmm.
The matter is beyond me. Treorc, remember your oath. So she's sacrificing as well for the good of the land.
Her anger and as a mother, my goodness, huh?
Mm-hmm.
She does, just a little further on, mention that, you know, she says almost kind of, you know, between her teeth that she hopes that the lords punish him.
Yeah. She prays, I pray that the lords will punish.
Mm. Yeah. And all the while, TC is like, you know, apparently nerves did regenerate in the land. So he's getting better, but the land is getting diseased.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
There's a... I mean, I'm not saying that one is, that there's a causal relationship, but I mean, in a sense, because I mean, there was some harmony that has been shattered now. I mean, quite apart from Lena, just, you know, his arrival, you know, brings about a sense of, you know, end times or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it does, it does. And we've also got that phrase that he will either save or damn the land.
Right. And then there's his raping of Lena, which, you know, in a harmonious place like that would just not happen. Certainly not in the stone down where she lives.
No.
And so, I mean, yeah, so there's desecration, there's that kind of, you know, poison or disease. And at the same time, Thomas's own body is kind of... healing.
Yeah.
As a result of the land.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess who knows what power and energy he took from Lena that he wasn't aware of being a taker of.
But he's angry. He says, why should I go? None of this matters. I don't give a damn about your precious land. And she says, by the seven. So I'm like, seven what?
Yeah, that must be like the biggest curse, like, you know, yeah. Yeah, right. And she's having none of it.
Yeah.
And he sees, I'm going to drag you if I have to. I mean, she must like, there's a bit where he asks for a bandage and I mean, she really despises him now.
Yeah.
I mean, she... And his behaviour is... I mean, it's easy to see why, you know, it would be despised and is kind of despicable. It is despicable. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever background and things, I mean... Yeah, I mean, certainly it's maybe also an indication of how much humanity was kind of... knocked out of him in however long it was between discovering that he was a leper. And remember how it came about, writing that crappy second novel.
Yeah.
Because he sat in his heart and he just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and ignored all the pain. And that brought it about. And then when he went back and read the novel, it was so shit, he just burnt it along with the first one. But, yeah.
But his first novel was a bestseller. So, and we also don't know much about his life up until that point.
Hmm.
What kind of a person he was.
He's got a young son, a 6-year-old or something. His wife, Joan.
Yeah, Joan.
She seemed happy enough to stay with him until the point where she realised... what the future was going to be, so...
Mm. I think, I mean, Roger was the son. Yeah. I think he was a bit younger than 6 at that point.
Right,
still
right,
a kind
okay.
of toddler.
Yeah. But I think a person who's strong enough to make a decision like that would be strong enough to make a decision to leave had he been a complete asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean,
that makes sense.
So, yeah, certainly. I mean, it seems like leprosy or the experience of it and the dealing of it was at the expense of most of his humanity.
Yeah.
Right? And that's certainly at display at the moment and gives the sense of being despicable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So that's it. The chat's done. She's going to drag him to Revelstone by hook or by crook. And he then picks up Treorc's knife, which Treorc had embedded into the earth. It's a sharp blade made of one piece of stone. And it's sharp enough to shave with. He cuts a hair off his arm to test the blade. And remember that shaving for Covenant is one of his rituals. One of his survival rituals.
Yeah.
And they head off, he with Treorc's blade in his belt. And started after Atiaran. So they're back on the move, but I would expect their relationship to be very different from here on in, now that she knows.
Right.
But Treorc disappeared, he just ran off after Atiaran had reprimanded him and forbade him from killing Covenant. So who knows if we'll see him again. But he's ran off with his tail between his legs.
Well, I mean, you know, he'll at least be good for comforting Lena. I mean,
yeah.
You know. But yeah. Interesting, the knife, a knife at a stone that's as sharp as that. Can't imagine it, but yeah.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything else I wanted to refer back to. There was just one thing I've written here which won't be relevant to you, but to anyone who's read Brandon Sanderson's Stormlight Archive, which has an oath pact of its own. So I'm just wondering how much these fantasy authors borrow from each other. This one is the Oath of Peace. And there was a mention of the Blood Guard at one point in this chapter, which we didn't land upon. We haven't met the Blood Guard, but I think that's twice they've been mentioned now. No, it's not. Here we are, yeah. When we're talking about the Ranahan, it says that no Ranahan has been ridden save by Lord or Blood Guard.
I see.
Since the age began. So that's another race that we haven't come across yet, but they've been mentioned a couple of times, along with the Giants and the Ramen. Or the Raymond, I'm not sure how you would pronounce that. The horse people.
Right.
So it's a dense chapter. There's relationship changes. There's the revelation of the rape. Treorc appears for the first time. We're introduced to the Ravers as a concept. And we get all of the history of the Lords that Atiaran explains to Covenant. So there's a lot in this chapter, actually. I think we did the right thing, just concentrating on one. What are you thinking? Any predictions? Still too early?
Yeah. I had wondered, before I figured out that everybody knew, that maybe she would go on to have his child.
Who, Lena?
Yeah.
Mm.
And that's right, yeah.
Interesting.
But, yeah, in terms of what may come about, yeah, right.
So we've got a long way to go, a lot of walking. I did mention the river, which is why they're not taking a direct route, but rather they're looking at using the soul's ease to use the river as a means of traversing the land.
It's easier walking, Because he has a go at her saying, why didn't you take the other route? And she said, well, wait till we get up there. It's going to be much easier.
Yeah, yeah. So, let's look at what we're going to cover for next time. Chapter 9, Jehanam. Starts 115 up to 141.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just stick with the one chapter. Yeah.
And it sounds very much like the Arabic word for heaven.
Right. Very good. Studying this with a linguist is quite an interesting idea.
Well, you're one yourself.
Yeah, fair enough. There's no Russian references or influence at all. At least none that I've noticed.
Shame you're not doing Clockwork Orange then.
Funny you should say that. I have it right here on my desk. I'm just showing it to the camera for those listeners who can't see what we're doing. So I'm going to be reading it again this month, which I'm looking forward to.
Right then.
Right then.
Okay, so see you in heaven.
Nice one. So, yeah, if any of you listeners have got some feedback for us, just drop it in. Let us know what you think of the chapter so far. If you're going to stick with it, I presume you are, because you have done after chapter 7. You're still here, so let us know what you think. If you're enjoying it, if you're looking forward to the rest of the story as it unfolds, and we'll see you back here.
Yeah, and just to say that for me at least, this is the first time I'm doing it. So be gentle, but I mean, feel free to say what you feel about the style of interaction and any improvements or any feedback, things like that. Feel free.
Yeah, we'll take it on board. Right, Barge, good to see you, my friend.
Okay, Cams. Rightio.
See you next time.
Bye then.
Bye. Just a wee addendum. We are now publishing on our own URL. So if you go to theunbelievers.co, that's .co, that's where we're publishing. And obviously, you know where we're publishing because you're listening to it. But it's going out on all of the podcast platforms and on YouTube. So I'm putting it onto my Cams Campbell Reads channel on YouTube. I'll put a link in the show notes. If YouTube's your thing and you want to support us there, it'd be a good place to go, and you can comment directly there on the podcast. Or if you would like to help us out just a little bit, we are a new podcast after all. So one of the most helpful things you can do would be to go to your podcatcher app of choice and leave us a review and a star rating. Five obviously would be amazing. Whatever you can do to help us, because for a new podcast, it's important that it gets some attention at the beginning so that it can fall in front of other people's ears. So we would really appreciate it if you would do that. It's an amazing book, and I know that you're reading along with us if you've got this far. So we would appreciate your support if you would do that for us. That would be amazing. Thank you.